You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the earth.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Monday, June 19th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the show. I hope you enjoy my swollen purple finger. I banged it up pretty good, nailing some nails yesterday, and it fingertips all blue and ugly, and it's made it very hard to type today. So I hope you know today's show comes to you under a great deal of pain for me. Pain and sacrifice, I give it to you all here on the Marijuana Agenda. On our show today, we're going to bring you the cannabis headline news first, and then we'll get to a very special edition of Government at Work, featuring our very first activist correspondent here on the Marijuana Agenda. Wayne Reese went out to the Cannabis World Congress and Business Expo, and he got the full remarks of State Senator Diane Savino from New York. So we'll play that for you in our extended Government at Work segment. We'll follow that up with the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle. We spoke with Regulate Rhode Island's Jared Moffitt on why his group and other civil rights groups are boycotting the legislature's suggested marijuana legalization study commission. Then we'll have time to get to a radical rant where I've got to let loose on the acquittal of Officer Geronimo Yanez in the killing of Philando Castile, and how the defense tried to paint him as a crazed marijuana maniac. All that's coming up on the Marijuana Agenda. Back right after this.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. For your $4.20 monthly donation, you'll receive over 20 hours of original first-hour podcasts plus other materials only available to paid subscribers. Or for just $9.99 a month, become a VIP patron. You'll get over 40 hours of podcasts for the complete program, including Toker Talk Radio, plus ad-free downloads of the segments heard on the Marijuana Agenda. Plus, VIPs get exclusive access to the video replay of the two-hour live stream show and downloads of the spreadsheets and charts I provide from my years of curating marijuana data sets. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at MJAgenda.com.
And now, another episode of Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre. I'm your host, Leonard Pinth-Garnell III. Tonight we take a look at one of the finest works in the cannabis cinema, 1996's Half-Baked, starring David Chappelle, as interpreted by the Royal Shakespearean Cannabis Theatre Company. In this scene, Chappelle's character, Thurgood Marshall, has just admitted his addiction to cannabis to a room full of narcotics addicts. One addict, played in the film by Robert Saget, and interpreted here by the Royal Company's Sir Frederick Farrakh, takes umbrage at the suggestion.
I find preposterous the notion that you, sir, may be addicted to cannabis. In times previous, I have undertaken lubricious endeavors, most revolting and unbecoming of a proper gentleman, in my servitude to the wicked powder of the coca leaf. Lo, that is an addiction whose chains would bind Hercules. At any point in history, could one identify a moment in your life so sullied by your ignominy as a cannabis slave? Methinks not! Boo this man!
For Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre, I'm Leonard Pinth-Garnell III.
The Marijuana Agenda. Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaolin Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com. City of Portland permit number 17-159855.
This is your cannabis headline news. brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Monday, June 19th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. The Minnesota police officer who shot and killed Philando Castile while his girlfriend filmed the encounter on Facebook Live was acquitted of all charges on Friday. Castile, a lawfully permitted gun owner, was stopped by Officer Geronimo Yanez last July. Castile informed Yanez he was a gun owner and had his weapon on him. When Yanez asked Castile to produce his license, Castile's movement frightened Yanez, who thought Castile was reaching for his gun, and Yanez shot him 7 times. Castile's girlfriend testified he was reaching for his license. The prosecution wondered why someone who was likely to shoot a cop would announce he had a gun in the first place. The defense brought up Castile's history of marijuana use, testifying that Yanez was on the lookout for a black robbery suspect, quote, with a wide nose, end quote, saying of Yanez's encounter with Castile that, quote, we have him ignoring commands. He's got a gun. He might be the robber. He's got marijuana in the car. Those are the things in Officer Yanez's head. We're not saying that Philando Castile was going to shoot Officer Yanez. What we're saying is that he didn't follow orders. He was stoned. End quote. The Washington Post reports that Congress is considering a bill that would expand the federal government's ability to pursue the war on drugs, granting new power to the Attorney General to set federal drug policy. The bipartisan legislation, sponsored by powerful committee chairs in both chambers of Congress, would allow the Attorney General to unilaterally outlaw certain unregulated chemical compounds on a temporary basis. It would create a special legal category for these drugs. The first time in nearly 50 years that the Controlled Substances Act has been expanded in any way. And it would set penalties, potentially including mandatory minimum sentences, for the manufacture and distribution of these drugs. The bill, introduced last week, known as the Stop the Importation and Trafficking of Synthetic Analogs, or CITSA Act of 2017, creates a new Schedule A into which the Attorney General could unilaterally place new drugs for 5 years without any evaluation of abuse potential or health risks. Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire has signed 2 bills into law that expand the Granite State's medical marijuana program. One is a bill that adds chronic pain as a qualifying condition for medical marijuana. The other bill expands access for patients with hepatitis C who previously could only qualify for medical marijuana if they were receiving antiviral treatments. According to the Department of Health, over half of New Hampshire's medical marijuana patients are already experiencing, quote, severe pain that has not responded to treatment, end quote. Prior to this new law, however, those patients had to be qualified under another condition besides pain. Michigan Public Radio reports that a pair of identical bills were introduced to the Michigan House and Senate Wednesday that would ban medical marijuana dispensaries and businesses from advertising on billboards. Senator Rick Jones and Representative Andy Shore said in a statement that the bills they introduced would mirror the state's ban on billboard advertising for tobacco. The legislators cite Centers for Disease Control research that notes tobacco advertising can increase usage by minors. Jones and Shore say they want to limit youth exposure to medical marijuana. Quote, we don't need massive marijuana billboards advertising the availability of medical marijuana or to find shops, and it shouldn't be advertising this to our children and others who may abuse it, end quote, said Shore. The state does not have a billboard advertising ban on alcohol, which also has an age limit. The Provo Daily Herald reports that activists in Utah are planning a medical marijuana initiative signature drive. In 2014, the legislature chose to legalize cannabidiol extract for use in controlling epileptic seizures. In 2016, 2 new laws, which would have legalized medical marijuana to differing extents, both passed through the Utah Senate, but never reached a vote in the House of Representatives. And in the 2017 session, the only marijuana legislation passed allowed only for studies to take place, which could take years to yield results. Despite the legislature's hesitancy to act on medical marijuana legalization, Utahns may have the chance to vote on the issue directly in the form of a ballot initiative in 2018. The language of the medical marijuana initiative is based off of the language from one of the bills that failed the legislature in 2016. The ballot would include access to the whole plant, though smoking it would be prohibited. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Monday, June 19th, 2017.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
At Herbie
Ronnie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the voice of the industry from the National Cannabis Industry Association. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
Marijuana has come a long way since President Richard Nixon signed the law declaring it a Schedule I drug. Since then, activists and lawmakers have been chipping away at prohibition at the state, local, and national level. Now, decriminalization, medical cannabis, and adult marijuana are realities throughout America. Join us as we learn more about how we're legalizing cannabis in this episode of Government at Work.
Welcome to this special edition of Government at Work. I'm Russ Belville. New York is one of the 29 states with active medical marijuana programs, but also one of four that does not allow marijuana smoking by patients. At the recent Cannabis World Congress and Business Exposition at the Javits Center, State Senator Diane Savino, a key figure in crafting New York's medical law, spoke about expanding the medical program and the prognosis for adult-use marijuana in the Empire State. Activist correspondent Wayne Reese was at the CWCBE and brings us Senator Savino's speech in its entirety.
I can't like walk past him and give him a quick kiss because I need a ladder to do so. Thank you for that lovely introduction, Margaret. And he's right. The first time we shared a dais together was 4 years ago at the first Cannabis World Expo here. I think we were at the Marriott Marquis. So it's interesting to see how much we've grown in 4 years, right? So I see Scott's in the back there somewhere. Amazing how much we've grown in the 4 years, no pun intended. And it's been an amazing 4 years for the marijuana industry, not just here in New York State, but across the country. And so, you know, I thought I'd talk a little bit about where we've been, where we're going, the history in New York State, and what I think are the next steps for cannabis. And I think one of the things I'd like to do is get us all used to talking about it and calling it cannabis. And it's hard even for me.
Yes.
Right? It is. It's hard. I still lapse into marijuana, but mostly what I would like to say to the members of the press that are here, and I know some of them are here, and you're going to write stories about this week, and you're going to talk about the convention and the event. Please, please, stop using words like weed and pot. Especially when you're talking about medical cannabis. We have to begin to change the way people think about it. And I want to start there. When I got involved in the quest to bring the Compassionate Care Act to the floor of the New York State Senate, eventually to the desk of Andrew Cuomo to have him sign it, I knew that I was taking on two issues. One was developing public health policy, you know, recognizing that we had New Yorkers, many of whom were suffering with a chronic, lifelong, debilitating condition, and they had one of two choices. They were either going to have to live with that condition, or they were going to have to become dependent upon highly addictive, dangerous drugs. And for them, they didn't want that. They wanted another choice. And they knew that in other parts of the country, in other states, those states had already taken a step forward in allowing those patients to have access to a tightly regulated, safe, clean product that provided them relief from those conditions. And why shouldn't we do that here in New York? After all, we're in New York. We're supposed to be the most progressive state in the East Coast, right? We were the first to pass, you know, a woman's right to vote, the first to adopt child labor laws. There were so many firsts in New York State. But we were also the last to adopt no-fault divorce. Sometimes New York leads and sometimes we follow. We're not a very progressive state on drug policy. Those of you who live here and follow drug policy know that it was only in 2010 that New York State repealed the most draconian drug laws in the country, Rockefeller drug laws. So we have a very, you know, I would say schizophrenic approach to drug policy. And that's where we were, that's where we were starting. But I felt it was important enough to begin to fight that fight because patients really needed access to a safe, reliable alternative to what was highly dangerous addictive drugs. It didn't help that I started this path when we were beginning to see the effects of some of the most dangerous drugs the FDA has ever approved. Whoever invented OxyContin, in my opinion, deserves a special place in hell. So that's where I began this journey. New York was on track to be the 23rd state. And so when I began the process, I partnered with a colleague in the Assembly, Assembly Member Dick Godfrey, who carried a companion bill in the Assembly for 17 years. 17 years he worked on trying to get a medical marijuana program in New York State. Never really got much traction in the New York State Senate. And I picked up the bill, and when I did, I decided that if I wanted to actually bring a policy and a law into New York State, maybe I should learn a little bit about the business. Because by then, we had a handful of states, in fact more, probably more, maybe about, as I said, when we passed the bill, we were the 23rd. So there were about 17 already in place, there were five or six that were in the pipeline. I said, if I want to do this seriously, let me go and visit a couple of these states and look at the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's see what works. Let's see what doesn't work. And knowing the state that I was in, as you know, New York is not an initiative and referendum state. We are a representative democracy, which means I had a much smaller group of people to convince. First, it was the 63 members of the New York State Senate, and then it was the most important member of the New York State legislature, that would be the governor, who was not particularly supportive of the idea at the time. And he's no more different than a lot of people in New York. He didn't understand it, he didn't see the value of it, he wasn't prepared to bring it in, he had a lot of concerns about it. So I had to approach this bill in a very deliberative way. Go out, visit states like Colorado, visit states like California, go to New Jersey, see what worked and what didn't work, how much regulation could harm the industry, how much oversight was important. And so we believe, in the end, we came up with a very balanced approach. We were on the verge of passing the bill, and at the very last minute, the governor realized it was going to pass with or without him. And so he decided to engage in some negotiation of his own, and he narrowed the program even tighter than we did. He insisted that we start with only 5 license holders. He insisted that we limit it to only 20 dispensaries, 5 license holders, 4 dispensaries each. He insisted we narrow the number of conditions. And he insisted that there be a time frame on the program so that if in fact there were tremendous problems in it, that if all of the things that people predicted could go wrong, did go wrong, that we could pull the plug on the industry. We believed that none of those things would happen, and so in the end, the bill was signed. And we insisted, though, that because people's lives were going to be affected by it, and as an industry, whoever's going to apply for these licenses, we're going to have to bear the entire burden of this industry. The state has almost no skin in this game except for the fact of the public policy interest. We have no investment in it. It's no state contract. Whoever applies for these licenses, they own everything, all of the risk and all of the return. And to date, if you would speak to any of the license holders, they'll tell you there hasn't been a lot of return. But in any event, we insisted that there be a very tight timeline in the legislation so that licenses would be issued timely, regulations would be drawn up timely, that there would be access to patients as quickly as possible. To their credit, they lived up to every one of those time frames. And within the first 18 months, all five licenses were issued. There were grow houses established in New York State. There were dispensaries open. And unfortunately, what we found pretty quickly on is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that we have encountered in New York State, and I know it's occurred in other states, though, is doctors. Doctors have been a tremendous impediment to this program in New York State. And the way the bill is drafted, if you're a patient and you qualify under the law, if you have one of the qualifying conditions, you have to go to your doctor. You have to talk to your doctor about whether or not you would like to participate in the program. The doctor has to make a recommendation to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health ultimately determines whether or not you qualify. They then issue you a card and you can participate. But it's that first step in the process, your doctor. A lot of doctors in New York State have been hesitant, reluctant to get involved in this program for a variety of reasons. One, doctors are naturally risk-averse. They don't know what they don't know. They didn't learn about it in medical school. And if they can't turn to the FDA for trusted research, they are reluctant to get involved. And the way the bill was structured, there was no way for patients to find doctors that were certified under the program. Also, doctors have to be trained under the program. They have to take an online training course for 4 hours and pay $195. Some doctors objected to that, too. They don't like it. Doctors think they're going to get sued. They think they're going to lose their license. They think there's a whole bunch of issues about it. So they've been somewhat reluctant to get involved. And as a result, access for patients has been hindered. We pushed the Department of Health, though, in the following 6 months to expand the provider pool to include nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Because after all, in New York State, if you are a nurse practitioner and physician assistant, you can write prescriptions for Schedule II substances. So why shouldn't you be able to treat patients and recommend them for medical marijuana? Department of Health agreed with us, and they have done that. So we've now expanded the pool of providers to include doctors, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, and we hope that that will do something to kind of increase access for patients, partly because doctors don't like competition. And if they see some of their patients turning to other practitioners, it may wake them up. We have also convinced the Department of Health that they should produce and publish the list of certified physicians who are participating in the program. They've agreed to do that as long as the doctors agree to have their names published, and they've done that to the extent that those doctors are willing to do so. And we're hoping that that will expand it. And we believe that the department is now considering expanding the number of licenses. I'm a little concerned about the expansion of licenses at this point in time because I don't believe that the patient base is there. I do think that patients in New York, though, what we do need is access points. I think that we should issue limited licenses. I made that recommendation to the Department of Health. Limited licenses for dispensary only, and then at a certain patient density in this state, we could expand full licenses for cultivation. Being in this business, if those of you who are in it or interested in it, is probably one of the most dangerous, and financially dangerous, most risky industry in the country, largely because of the federal government. And this is where I want to go now. So we are now at a point in this country where 66% of the American population lives in a state where we have either legal or recreational marijuana or both. 66% of the American population. We have 29 states that have a legal form of marijuana. Where there are eight adult use states, Maine, Massachusetts, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, and Alaska. All became so by public referendum. Vermont nearly became the first to do it by legislation, but unfortunately the governor vetoed it. But in 29 states, we have legal marijuana in some way, shape, or form, which means the public, the people, are indicating their tremendous support for marijuana policy change. And yet and still, you have a federal government that seems to be on a different planet. Seriously, on a different planet. Normally the way, you know, huge public policy changes occur, they start at the state level. You know this old expression that the states are the incubator of ideas. And so when you see something happening in California, then you'll see it happening in New York, you'll see it pop up in Rhode Island, and then, you know, it's not by accident, by the way. You know, we don't all suddenly wake up and, you know, have mental telepathy and start passing legislation in individual states. It starts because there's a movement, usually, and people are usually part of that movement. And you'll see individual legislators in individual states start to talk about issues because people are talking about those issues in their districts, in their communities, and in their states. And when you start to see it happening across the country slowly, eventually your federal government will pay attention, your congressional members will pay attention, and the federal government will say, well, this makes no sense. You can't have a hodgepodge of legislation. You can't have 30 states with 30 different forms of regulations over this industry, because that makes no sense, right? It doesn't make any sense. No other industry would do that. That's usually when the federal government will say, we need a federal regulatory structure. We need federal law to oversee this. Should have happened 12 states ago. But here we are, almost 30 states in, and we still have a federal government that continues to maintain this position that marijuana is a Schedule I substance, which means it is dangerous and has no redeemable value, none whatsoever. In spite of evidence to the contrary, in spite of the millions of patients who have derived public health benefit as a result of it, in spite of the fact that we have countries outside, you know, there are countries outside of the United States, just in case some of you don't know that. When I talk to federal officials, and they raise the issue that there's no research to substantiate the benefit of medical marijuana. Did you know that there's no research anywhere? I said, well, what about Canada? What about Ireland? What about Israel? It's as if those places don't exist to them. If it wasn't done here in the United States, if it's not approved by the FDA, it's as if the research was never done. It's the most amazing disconnect that I've ever seen. But it is as real as anything in Washington. And so here we are, 29 states in. Some of those states, by the way, are making so much money off the sale of marijuana that they are able to pay for their public education systems. Imagine that. And still, Washington won't do anything about it. And we seem to have lulled ourselves into a false sense of security for people who were in the industry and people who were policymakers, that we were safe from Washington, that they weren't going to take any negative action against us, because first we had the Cole Amendment, you know, and then we had Rohrabacher and Blumenauer now, and, you know, the Congress would put into their budget that they couldn't use any of the money from the federal budget to go after states, and everyone kind of lulled themselves into a false sense of security, in spite of the fact that if you are a licensed, is there any single license holder in this room? Anybody interested in me, you are, so you know what it's like. If you are interested in this business, everything you do, every dollar that you make imagine running a business where everything that you do and every dollar you make, you cannot claim on your federal tax return. You can't put the money in the bank. You can't go to traditional investments. It's just so complicated because everything you do is considered illegal by one level of government. It's absurd. If you are in the business and you are required to deliver your tax revenue, your tax bill to the state that you're operating in, and you can't put the money in the bank, how do you do it? You've got to bring it in cash. And by the way, any of you who have seen this, this cash stinks. Because they have to secure the cash in the same vaults that they have to secure the products in. It's the most absurd environment for a business that you've ever seen. So, but here we are. You would think, again, that you have members of Congress who represent these states that are deriving a tremendous amount of tax revenue that is supporting their state's operations, that they would turn to their colleagues in Congress and say, we gotta do something about this. This makes no sense whatsoever. Instead, we've all been lulled into this false sense of security that nobody in Washington was going to do anything as long as you were in a state that had a legal regulated program and you were operating within the constraints of that legal regulated program. If you operate outside of it, of course, and you have a license, then, you know, the feds will come after you. But as long as you were operating within the constraints of that legal regulated program in your state, you would be safe. And you can then deal with all the other problems of operating a business that the federal government said is illegal anyway. Well, I'm not so sure anymore. Because as we saw just last week, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States, is ask Congress, yeah, boo, 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 exactly, is ask the Congress to give him the power to go into states, legal states, and to raid their legal marijuana programs. That should send a chill down the spine of every, first of all, every legislator in the Congress and every state legislator in this country. There is such a thing called the, you know, states' rights and the separation between the federal government and the states' rights and the sovereign state. We are all duly elected legislators in our own states. We have the power to adopt regulations and laws in our own states. And the idea that the United States Attorney General would threaten individual states that have taken the time and the opportunity to adopt programs in their own states is frightening to me. That is the abuse of authority of the highest order. And to ask Congress to give him permission is even worse. Now, I don't think that Congress is going to go along with it, but it's not enough for them to just say no. I believe at this point in time, it is time for Congress to do something. If they believe that medical marijuana has value because there are patients in their states that have seen a change in their quality of life, that are getting the benefit of treatment that they wanted, that have seen improvements, then they need to do something. They need to put their money where their mouth is, and they need to deschedule marijuana. Whether they want to do it for, they don't want to do it for recreational, they're not ready, then they need to do it for medical marijuana. And we need to demand that they do that. So, I believe my responsibility now as a state legislator is to continue to fit, you know, to work on the New York program, to stabilize it, to help it grow, again, no pun intended. I know I have a colleague that was here earlier today, Senator Krueger, and I think Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples Stokes from Rochester. We're here to talk about the path forward for recreational in New York State. You know, God bless them. I know Andrew Cuomo, I just don't see him being supportive of recreational adult use. He was very insistent on the medical program being small, narrow, and demanded that we not allow smoking under the program. So it's just my own opinion, I don't see him moving towards adult recreational use. And in most states where we have adult recreational use, it takes about 10 years after medical. So I believe the best path towards adult recreational use in New York State is to stabilize the medical program in New York State, expand the patient base, have more events like this where people, you know, we begin to see cannabis, marijuana as less of a threat, more of something that's in our mainstream, in our business world, and in our medical world. But I do think also as a legislator from a state that has adopted it, that says that we have our own laws, our own constitution, and our own way of adopting rules and regulations, that I have a responsibility upon the ending of our legislative session, which is next week, to go to Washington and to put my time and effort into lobbying the members of Congress to take their foot off the neck of this industry, deschedule marijuana, and provide some stability, not just to patients, but to an industry that is growing by leaps and bounds. And I look forward. That all of you who are interested in this, whether you're interested in it for personal reasons or for professional reasons, that you would join in those efforts. Change has to now come through the halls of Congress. We cannot trust, I don't believe, the Attorney General's office. We can't trust the Justice Department. I'm not sure what the White House thinks. You know, I heard the President speak during the campaign that he believes in medical marijuana. I don't think he's too keen on recreational, but he can do something about it by putting his signature on a piece of legislation that the Congress can pass. Laws are made by Congress, they're not made by the Justice Department, and we need Congress to act. So that's what I will be doing going forward, and you know, I hope to see you guys all here next year at the Cannabis World Expo, and hopefully we'll have some good news to share, that Congress has finally done the right thing by the 66% of the American people that have said the time is right for change in marijuana policy. Thank you all for coming.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. If you're an organization or business looking to promote your brand, we have sponsorship patronage available at MJAgenda.com. Sponsorship includes 15 and 30 second ad breaks and 6 minute interviews on the podcast, depending on sponsorship level, which begins at $19.99 a month. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at MJAgenda.com.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson, or Norman, and I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the pharmaceutical agenda, without all the side effects, overdose, deaths, insurance.
Side effects may include nausea, dry mouth, and constipation. Dry mouth, constipation, indigestion, and abdominal pain.
Which can occur without warning and may cause death.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. Trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
Welcome to the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle. Today, we catch you up on the latest news and speak with an expert from the Northeast region of the United States, from New England to the Mid-Atlantic, including the evolution of consumer cannabis in Massachusetts and Maine. Now, let's return to the birthplace of our nation in this edition of the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle.
Welcome to the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle. I'm Russ Belville, and as we continue taking a look at the progress of marijuana law reform in the northeastern states in the United States, we take a look at the smallest one, the state of Rhode Island, where Jared Moffitt is joining us from Regulate Rhode Island to discuss the situation. Jared, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, we're really excited about the prospects of passing legalization in the state of Rhode Island. It's long been looked at as a state that could do so through the legislative process. And I've been paying attention out here from the West Coast, and things seem to be going pretty well with the legislature putting together a legalization plan, but now there's been kind of an update on this that makes things seem like they're not going as well as I might have thought. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about this latest development you sent out in your press release?
Sure. So, well, in just a little bit more context, you know, we started the legislative session really strong. I mean, we had a new poll out showing, you know, nearly 60% of voters in the state, backing our efforts for legalization. When our sponsors introduced the legalization bill in the House, we got 25 co-sponsors out of a total of 75. So one in three House members were on our side, and had an even bigger proportion in the Senate. And, so in the face of sort of that, pretty significant legislative and public support, the leadership of both chambers basically just sort of ignored all that and gave the issue pretty minimal attention. We just had one hearing in the House, one hearing in the Senate, I'm happy that a few of the members really stuck through and listened to us the whole time, but a lot of the members you know, weren't even there. And now they're saying they want more time to study the issue. And so we're a little confused because, you know, if you wanted to study the issue, why wasn't it studied at the committee hearings? Why weren't there more hearings? Why wasn't there more attention paid to the issue? So, you know, I think the people, you know, in our coalition and you know, the supporters that we have across the state are very frustrated with the process. And, you know, I don't blame the rank and file legislators in the state because, frankly, most of them that we've talked to, they want to vote on this. They think it's time to have a vote. You know, it's been 7 years that a bill like this has been introduced. It's really the leadership of both chambers. It's the way that the process is a very top-down, you know, very leadership-heavy involved process. And for whatever reason, and we never really got a good explanation, the leadership decided they didn't want to hold a vote on our issue this year. So, you know, in response, we basically said, okay, well, you know, you haven't listened to us. You've shown no interest in working with us. So we don't want to be a part of this, you know, flawed study commission that you guys are proposing because it's a joke. You know, the language in this study commission bill talks about what it's supposed to do, and it mentions Colorado and Washington as states that they're supposed to study, but they didn't even, you know, take the effort to write out the other six states that have legalized marijuana. So if it's a really, you know, if it's supposed to be a good faith effort to analyze the issue, and you can't even take the time to list all the states that have legalized marijuana and include that as part of the study, I mean, we're just not buying it. We think this is basically a joke. So that's why we're not participating.
This is it really does sound like one of these kick the can down the road sort of situations. And in other states that I've covered, it's always been pressure from law enforcement or drug rehab groups or pharmaceutical groups somehow. But you don't find any particular pressures. You don't have any idea what might be causing this reticence from the leadership.
We really have no good idea because, you know, what's been said publicly by the speaker is, you know, we didn't see much support from the legislators, from the members of the House. And I find that hard to believe given that, again, our legislation had 25 co-sponsors. The study commission bill only had 18 co-sponsors. So I'm not sure why the study commission bill was allowed to get a vote and move forward, but our issue wasn't. So, you know, I suspect that, you know, what's really going on is perhaps that, you know, the speaker, the leadership in the House, you know, really doesn't like our issue for whatever reason. I mean, I know he's pretty conservative on a lot of other issues. He just doesn't want to say that publicly because he knows, you know, that there's a cost to that. And so I think he's trying to play both sides. And that's why they put up the study commission bill, because it was an easy out. It's a way, it's an excuse to not vote on the issue this year. And, you know, he wanted us to go along with that. And we said, no, thanks.
Oh, wow. All right. So it boggles the mind trying to figure out what else might need to be studied about marijuana legalization, given that it's been 5 years in play in Colorado and Washington, 3 years in play in Oregon and Alaska. You got four other states that have voted on this. Massachusetts and Maine have passed it. I can't imagine what they're holding this up for any legitimate reason. It does sound like it's again, a kick the can down the road thing. What is it that you're proposing? Are you proposing something that's way out of bounds compared to any of the other legalization states?
Not at all. I think our proposal at the beginning of the session was very reasonable, you know, we support home grow, but we knew that was an issue that the legislature had concerns about. So, you know, we decided to compromise a little bit and have a pretty low, limit for home growing. And that was a big concession. We, you know, agreed to go along with some pretty strict regulations and things that, you know, that folks in the legislature and regulators had said that they wanted. And, you know, we went along with that. And now what we've done in the past few weeks is we've introduced an even more watered down compromise proposal that's basically modeled on what the Vermont legislature did. So to legalize possession on July 1st, 2018, and then set up an advisory board of just six people to study how that the regulatory system should be set up so that if the General Assembly wants to move forward next year, they already have recommendations for what to do. That's an extremely watered down sort of, you know, legalization compromise. And they haven't wanted to even look at that. The speaker said there's not enough time to look at it, even though, you know, it's a very, very simple proposal. So, you know, for whatever reason, we've basically gotten the cold shoulder. And, you know, I think we're going to continue fighting in the Senate. And I think that we have at least some shot of getting a little bit better results in the Senate. But, you know, you mentioned the other states too. What's really bizarre about this proposal to study is, of course, stores are going to be opening in Massachusetts next year in July. And so, you know, one of the arguments we've been consistently making is, what are you really accomplishing by delaying this? Rhode Islanders are going to have access to legal marijuana next year anyway. So, you know, most Rhode Islanders live within about a 10 to 15 minute drive of the border. So what are you really accomplishing? I mean, it seems like all they're doing is, you know, taking an opportunity to create jobs and bring new business investment to the state, create some tax revenue. And they're just saying, no, we'd rather all that go to Massachusetts. So, you know, it's really hard to wrap my head around what's going on in their heads. So we're kind of at a loss.
Yeah, that's amazing. And one other aspect of this that caught my eye, the reform movements on the East Coast, especially when we saw the legalization campaign in Washington, D.C., concentrated a lot on the racial disparities and the racial justice issue of marijuana legalization. I see in your press release that the president of the NAACP and the director from Direct Action for Rights and Equality, two groups that are fighting those racial justice issues, have joined your side. Is there anything else you can tell us about that angle and how racial justice is playing into this campaign?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a big, big part of it. It's, you know, a lot of our coalition members and advocates that we work with, you know, that's their top issue. And, you know, speaking for me personally, it's why I got involved with drug policy in the first place, was the, you know, sort of the racial injustice, the social injustice surrounding it all. So I think that's a big motivator. And, you know, I'm happy that our coalition partners agreed with us that this wasn't a legitimate process and decided to sort of stand in solidarity. But yeah, I mean, you know, thousands of Rhode Islanders have criminal records for low-level marijuana offenses, and it's done enormous damage to our communities. And, you know, of course, there's the racial, disparate rates of arrest that we've seen. So, you know, I think a lot of people are really scratching their head. This is a win for social justice. It's a win for, you know, the economy. It's a win for just common sense. It's a win for, you know, sort of libertarian values. So there's so many sort of interest groups that are part of our coalition, you know, that, again, it's just sort of baffling why we weren't able to get more consideration from the House leadership.
Mm. What are the current penalties in the state of Rhode Island for simple possession of marijuana?
So possession of less than an ounce is decriminalized. It's basically a $150 fine. But of course, you know, it's still illegal and a crime to buy it and sell it. So, you know, we're obviously happy that, you know, possession is no longer a criminal offense, at least for less than an ounce, but we know that arrests are still happening. You know, people that have, over an ounce, you know, people that are, you know, caught selling low levels, that's still an arrestable offense. And we see from 2013 and 2014, which is the most recent data that I've been able to find, there were about 1,400 arrests in Rhode Island from those 2 years, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. But again, you've got to consider the fact that these people now have criminal records. That's going to make it, you know, more difficult to get jobs, more difficult to get housing. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about criminal justice reform in the state. And we think this, you know, sort of dovetails with that.
One other difference I can point out between East Coast and West Coast legalization reform is out here on the West Coast, we've had seriously entrenched medical marijuana interests that have sometimes spoken out against legalization, even going so far as campaigning against it. But I see in your press release a statement from the Rhode Island a spokesperson for Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, who's on your side as far as backing out of this this study commission. So what is the state of play between the medical side and the hope for recreational legalization in Rhode Island? Is there a conflict, or do the two sides seem to be working together?
I think largely we're working together, and I think that the solidarity increased a lot this year. We saw the head of the Rhode Island Patient Advocacy Coalition, Joanne Lepinen, testify in support of our bill. And, you know, I think the motivation for that is there's been a lot of changes to the medical marijuana program in the past couple of years that have made it, you know, more expensive and more onerous to be a medical marijuana patient. Essentially, I think, unfortunately, the state has begun to look more and more at medical marijuana as a revenue source. And, you know, obviously, we don't think that's the right way to go. We think people that use it as medicine shouldn't be taxed. And so I think that they see that by legalizing it for everyone, that opens up that revenue from folks that just use it for fun, which we don't have a big issue with, and takes the pressure off them. And not only that, it removes a lot of the barriers to access that patients confront. So, you know, I think it's a win because we're going to be increasing access for folks that need it for medical use. And, you know, I think that we definitely stand together on that. So they have concerns about making sure that, you know, when there is a legal market, that there's not a a scarcity of supply for medical marijuana, which, of course, is a very important thing to worry about and to address. But overall, you know, they do support what we're doing, and they think it could benefit people who need it for medical reasons.
That's fantastic news. Jared Moffitt is the director of Regulate Rhode Island, working to reform marijuana laws out there in the Ocean State. And Jared, do you have any contact information for our listeners if they want to learn more or help you out?
Sure, yeah. You can, you know, definitely check out our website, regulateri.com. We're on Facebook, just regulateri. You know, if folks want to get in touch with me, you can find my phone number and email address on the website. It's just info@regulateri.com. And, you know, my phone number is on there as well. So, yeah, I mean, happy to touch base with anyone that wants to learn more.
Thanks so much, Jared, for the work you're doing, and good luck in the state of Rhode Island.
Appreciate it, Russ. Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Buddy, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
And now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
So, you finally got to wear your shoes the right way. You're picking out your own clothes. Your own music. You're going to the mall by yourself. And that haircut? That was your idea. You're making your own decisions. So don't blow this one. Don't smoke pot.
To combat this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the conservative agenda, minus the hypocrisy.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for Shark Sessions from the Marijuana Show. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave the state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Well, as we briefly mentioned on Friday's show, Philando Castile's killer, Officer Geronimo Yanez, was acquitted of all charges in a Minnesota courtroom. He was charged with second-degree manslaughter and charged with endangering safety by discharging a firearm in public. This was the case that was streamed live on Facebook by his girlfriend as she sat next to his bullet-ridden body, having been shot point-blank 7 times by the police officer. Now, in the case, and this is what I want to focus on in the rant, is the defense, which put Philando Castile on trial, not the officer that killed him, put Castile on trial by pointing out repeatedly that Philando Castile was a marijuana consumer. Throughout the trial, they worked hard, the defense worked hard to make sure to paint Philando Castile as some sort of dangerous, drug-dealing, drug-using type. According to the New York Times, Mr. Gray, the defense lawyer, said Officer Yanez had to react quickly to what he believed was an imminent threat. He said Officer Yanez smelled marijuana, believed that Mr. Castile matched the description of a recent robbery suspect, and saw him grabbing a gun. Now, he smelled marijuana. The robbery, there was one of those looking for a young black man descriptions. A black man with a wide nose was part of the description. And since Philando was black and had a wide nose, well, every reason to be scared, right? So he approaches this is a guy he pulled over for a brake light, by the way. The brake light was out, pulls him over. Philando Castile was a lawful gun owner and mentioned that to the officer, said, hey, look, officer, he's not moving. He's just being chill. Says, officer, I'm a licensed concealed carry holder. I've got my weapon with me. I just thought you should know that. And then the cop tells him, all right, I need to see your license and registration. And when he moves to go get his license registration, that's when the cop shoots him and kills him. Keep in mind, the girlfriend was in the passenger seat and the girl's 4-year-old daughter was in the back seat when 7 shots were fired point blank into that car. But according to the defense attorney, Mr. Gray, he told the jurors, quote, we have him ignoring commands. He's got a gun. He might be the robber. He's got marijuana in his car. Those are the things in Officer Yanez's head. He did what he had to do. We're not saying that Philando Castile was going to shoot Officer Yanez. What we're saying is that he did not follow orders. He was stoned. End quote. The question as to whether or not he was following orders is still up in the air, as his girlfriend testified that he was reaching for his wallet, was reaching for his ID as he was ordered. He was killed for following orders, at least from the girlfriend's point of view. And if you're going to give a guy an order, don't move, get me your license, which of those orders are you supposed to disobey? Don't move or get me your license. This case here, and keep in mind, Philando Castile had been pulled over like 49 times. Philando Castile had been pulled over 49 times in the past 13 years. 49 times in 13 years. I've been driving since I was 17 years old. I've been pulled over maybe 3 or 4 times in my life. And this guy's been pulled over 49 times in 13 years. For the people out there that say that there's only a few bad apples and there's no racism or anything like that, I just demand that you explain to me how this guy would have gotten pulled over 49 times in 13 years. And if this were a white man who was a lawful concealed carry holder who got shot point blank 7 times, if this verdict would be the same. Now, there's people out there that'll say the jury had 2 black people on it and the jury acquitted him and the jury of his peers, yada, yada, yada. But you got to understand, the bar for trying to prosecute a police officer for killing someone is so high that it's, as we're seeing, nearly impossible, regardless of situation, to hold these killers to account so long as they can convince a jury at the time. Oh, gee, at the time I was afraid. I was afraid. That's all the excuse a cop needs.
Follow NTA10 on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube. and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
We'll have more of this in hour two. Plus, we're going to take a look at Jeff Sessions defending the drug war and the Boston newspapers helping out the weed dealers. That's all coming up on Toker Talk Radio. I'm Radical Russ. Until next time, take care of each other, Tokers!